This year, we launched a new Goop travel series called The Goop List. I wanted a way to share annually what I found to be the best of the best, from my favorite places to stay in Italy to a truly special spa in Costa Rica. If you are inspired to travel more this year, perhaps because you perused our recommendations on the Goop List, hosting on Airbnb is excellent for people who frequently travel. The beauty of hosting on Airbnb is that while you're away, someone else can get as much joy from your home as you do. Alongside frequent travelers, Airbnb is also great for those who have extra space or an in-law suite that isn't always being used. If you've stayed at an Airbnb before, you know the unique experience it offers. Now you can share that same experience with others while earning some extra income. To learn more about hosting on Airbnb, head to airbnb.com/host.
Don't hold anything too tightly. Just wish for it, want it, let it come from the intention of real truth for you, and then let it go.
For me, our soul is like, it's unbound, it's limitless, but we will use words to limit ourselves.
When people stop believing that somebody's got your back or Superman's coming, we turn to ourselves, and that's where you become empowered.
Courageous participation attracts positive things.
I'm Gwyneth Paltrow, and this is the Goop Podcast, where we bring together visionaries, scientists, healers, artists, and seekers. I'm so grateful that I get to interview these extraordinary thought leaders and share their wisdom with you. And I love listening to the conversations that are led by my co-host and dear friend, Cleo Wade. Cleo is a beautiful poet and author. I deeply admire her and the way she keeps her heart open to the world. Together, we believe that engaging in open-minded, honest, and sometimes difficult conversations has the power to change our lives. All right, over to Cleo.
My guest today is Claire Bidwell-Smith. Claire is a grief therapist and the author of a new book called Conscious Grieving, a transformative approach to healing from loss. In it, she explores how we navigate grief, drawing from her own experience of losing both of her parents by age 25, which ultimately led her into a career as a grief therapist. Claire has now spent nearly two decades helping her clients transform their grief, and I'm honored today to share her wisdom with you. So let's get to my conversation with Claire Bidwell-Smith. Wow, what a beautiful book.
Thank you.
I got to know your work for the first time while going through this book, and then being able to look at some of your other books as well. And at a time where there's so much grief in a macro way and in micro ways, that, you know, when your scroll online seems as though it's filled with more death than life and light and joy, it feels like the more immediate and the deaths that happen very close or near to you or right in your community somehow feel emphasized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of collective grief right now. And I think there has been, you know, a lot of events in the world, including the pandemic, but politics and wars and so many things going on. And each one kind of amplifies our own micro losses as well.
I have a million questions for you. But yeah. On that note, I just was wondering about how our brains aren't really able to process the amount of news, loss, tragedy, violence, the news being on a constant minute to minute in the palm of our hands. Do you think that that also just makes being able to grieve consciously much harder? Because when there's that much in the world, I often feel that people are constantly telling us that they're plugging off or they're turning off to deal with their mental health or to deal with this or to feel this. Do you think that that is making it harder for us to grieve?
It really is. I think you're right. You know, we're not very good at regulating the amount of information we're downloading on a minute by minute basis. And I think it contributes to a lot of anxiety, which is something else I talk about a lot in grief. But I think to your point, we're not making space to consciously grieve. We're not making enough space to really sit with it. And when we don't do that, it spills out in all kinds of other ways. But it's so hard in today's culture to make that space.
Also, with every way that we're on our phones designed to make us addicted. It's like the difference between eating, you know, Doritos and broccoli or something. Like, there's some foods that make you feel that you're addicted to whatever is in it that is like kind of lighting your brain up in that moment. Yeah. And then there's the things that aren't the same, you know, that not everything is like chocolate cake. And so
Our brains are getting rewired these days, and it's really hard. And our brains get rewired in grief too. You know, our brain chemistry really changes when we go through a significant loss. And so that kind of impacts it. And I think the ability to consciously grieve and to engage with grief and to make space for it, it requires a lot of effort. And sometimes it requires walking and holding a lot of pain. And there's so many distractions readily available to, you know, escape that pain. So I think it's a hard endeavor sometimes for a lot of people.
I think about that a lot when I'm writing, because something that people I find respond to the most is when I've written any type of affirmation that says there are some things where you never get to be the same again. Mm-hmm. And in my heart, I feel that I'm always referencing the ways that the hardest things we go through rewire our brains and just completely change us on a cellular level. Mm-hmm. And I think especially grief. And do you feel that it can be affirming for people so you can move forward and you stop trying to wrestle with trying to be the person you were before?
Yeah, I think it can be relieving, you know, to just have someone give you that permission to move forward knowing you aren't ever going to be the same again. And I think for a lot of people, there's a version too where they don't want to be the same. You know, this huge thing has happened and you do feel changed forever. And there's a way in which, you know, you don't want to go on being the same with this person gone. And then there's a version too, where you do, you want everything to stop and you don't want anything to change. And loss is about change and grief is about change. And so it's a push pull, right? I think there's two sides of it. But I do think there's some relief in accepting that you're going to be a different person going forward. But I think the thing that people trip up on is that often feels really scary and maybe like a bad thing. And it's not always a bad thing. I think I see a lot of people go through immense transformation and find really beautiful new parts of themselves when they move through deep grief and big loss. And that can be hard to hear in the beginning of a huge loss. You're like, I don't want hope and transformation and all those things, but they do come in time. You know, this idea of like post-traumatic growth, post-loss growth, it's real.
Now, that really makes me think about the beginning of your journey as a grief therapist, or the seed, because you entered into a relationship with big loss in your childhood. Can you kind of tell us about your journey to becoming a grief therapist?
Yeah, I always say nobody grows up wanting to be a grief therapist. When I was a kid, I wanted to be a writer, which I am. This is my fifth book. But when I was 14, both of my parents got cancer at the same time. I'm an only child. And my mom died when I was 18, when I was a freshman in college. And she was just, she was my best friend. She was such a magical mom and just an incredible woman and person in the world. And losing her really was, you know, dropped the floor out from underneath me. And you know, completely changed the landscape of my life, my identity, my future. And then my father died 7 years later when I was 25. And so for 10 years, I had been grappling with their mortality, you know, just different ideas of the world that my peers weren't thinking about as much. And I entered into young adulthood with a lot of grief, a lot of anxiety, no immediate family, you know, feeling very alone and lost. And from there, I kind of hit rock bottom in a lot of ways. You know, at the time my mom died in 1997, and there was not this incredible amount of resources around grief. There wasn't the acknowledgement of it. We weren't talking about trauma the way we are now. And so everyone around me just told me I would be fine and just to keep going. And you're an adult and you had your parents long enough, and, you know, and I wasn't fine, but because everybody was telling me that I should be, I thought there was something else wrong with me. And so I buried myself in a range of overachieving, alcohol, you know, toxic relationships, everything that didn't work, until I finally realized I had to figure out some things that did. And from there, you know, that looked like therapy, it looked like yoga, meditation, just really starting to reach out for support and understand what I was going through. And from there, I ended up going back and getting my master's in clinical psychology and becoming a therapist. And my first job out of school was in hospice. because I realized that there was just not enough support and conversation around death and dying. And because I was so immersed in it and so comfortable with it, I was like, well, I guess I should do it. Nobody else in my grad school wanted to touch grief. And so I've been now a therapist for 15 years and working in private practice. And I love this work so much. People ask me all the time if it's sad, and of course, but it's also really beautiful. I mean, I feel like I get to be with people every day who are in their most raw, real, deep states of being. And there's something really profound about that.
How have some of your, whether it's the people that you've seen in your private practice or those you served during, and that were in hospice, how did they inspire this book or your writing in general, or are they kind of the muses behind your work? Because having read your work, you can very much tell you're a writer and not someone who is kind of clinically just expressing their learnings in a field. It feels that you're inspired and you write in a way that writers write, where something they saw something and it sparked something that helped you to connect to a greater human spiritual feeling, almost in a way that creates such belonging. Are there kind of particular people that especially helped you kind of get to this? Because you've written about anxious anxiety, which you kind of introduced, and I want to talk about that too, but were there specific cases that really helped you kind of tap into the idea that we needed to talk about grieving consciously?
Mm-hmm. That's a really meaningful line of questioning. Thank you. I appreciate that. I like the word muses. I learn something new from every single person I sit with who is in grief. I went into this work thinking I knew a lot about it because I had gone through so much loss. And the moment I began to sit down with people, I was like, oh, I only know my grief. And there's so many other kinds of grief and so many other kinds of relationships and ways to be in the world. And I feel constantly humbled by this work. And I now go into it feeling like, you know, it's like, as you get older, you realize you know less. And when we're younger, we think we know so much. And so I feel like I know less and less about grief, even though I also know more and more at the same time. Yeah. But each person teaches me so much. And the anxiety and grief book really was born out of first my own experience of anxiety with grief. I immediately was having panic attacks after my mother died, ended up in the ER, had a lot of just kind of debilitating anxiety. And I began to write about it at some point. And then I was flooded with clients who were like, is this a thing? I think I have this anxious grief as well. And nobody was talking about it at the time. And I just started to see all these clients with different variations of it. And I felt really called to write that book. And then it came out during the pandemic, when the whole world was experiencing anxiety and grief, which was a really strange experience to kind of be holding that space for people and recognizing it and giving people permission to, you know, really look at the correlation between anxiety and grief. And then this book is, you know, it's kind of like the synthesis of everything I know about grief. And the biggest thing I know about it is that we have to make space for it, and we actually have to lean into it in order to heal. When we don't do those things, again, it just spills out in all the wrong places and all the wrong ways. So this book is my invitation to anyone, everyone grieving, to really lean into it.
How do you define grieving consciously? The word conscious, it's something that, you know, conscious eating, conscious this, conscious that, you know,
it's such words a buzzword.
Like, yeah. And I talk about this a lot with, whether it's words like self-care, vulnerability, or even trauma, when they become a buzzword, they're used so much that they start to mean something different to everyone, because depending on what website you read more often than not, or who you follow on social media, or how it's being used or was introduced to you in our kind of cultural zeitgeist, you have a completely different, like, you just might think vulnerability just means crying, being able to cry in front of people. And like, that's what it means. And so I'm interested in how you chose the word conscious and what that means to you in grief.
To me, it really means intention, you know, like intentional grieving. Like, we're really going to take ownership over this process, lean into it, examine it, learn from it, engage with it. Loss feels like it's this big thing that's happening to us. And loss is something that happens to us. It's not invited. It's not intentional. It's not something we are, you know, asking for. We're not asking for this horrendous loss to happen to us, losing somebody we really love or losing something we love. It's not something we invite in, yet it happens. How we choose to grieve is up to us, you know, so we can be intentional about it. We can open up to the process. We can explore it. We can sit with it. We can ask for support through it. Or like most of us, we run from it, you know? And so again, this is this idea that leaning into it is really the most important thing we can do when we're grieving.
Let's take a quick break to talk about one of our partners. This year, we launched a new Goop travel series called The Goop List. I wanted a way to share annually what I found to be the best of the best, from my favorite places to stay in Italy to a truly special spa in Costa Rica. If you are inspired to travel more this year, perhaps because you perused our recommendations on The Goop List, hosting on Airbnb is excellent for people who frequently travel. The beauty of hosting on Airbnb is that while you're away, someone else can get as much joy from your home as you do. Alongside frequent travelers, Airbnb is also great for those who have extra space or an in-law suite that isn't always being used. If you've stayed at an Airbnb before, you know the unique experience it offers. Now you can share that same experience with others while earning some extra income. To learn more about hosting on Airbnb, head to airbnb.com/host. Okay, let's get back to the conversation.
As you were speaking about leaning into it, I was thinking about my very best friend. Her dad passed suddenly in late September. And something I've noticed a lot about her journey is the anxiety management, which has actually really deeply impressed me, because I was saying this about her the other day, is that I feel that she's building a house for Joy to live in, even though Joy doesn't live there yet. Mm-hmm. I was joking at like, she's just doing all these things that I don't like to do, which is frustrating. So I'm like, oh, she wants to wake up in the morning and run 10 miles. I'm like, I'm not doing that, but I still want to have you sleep over at my house and like go on vacation. Or she'll be like, oh, I want to, you know, go find a workout class at like noon or whatever. But it's, I was saying that it's really been beautiful to watch her kind of pick up, you know, she like keeps the artist way book with her and has just been writing a lot and doing and scheduling her day and finding ways in which scheduling her kind of meals and having goals for her like body in very healthy ways. But what I was thought was really interesting about reading your work is that I was like, wow, it's so, cause she hasn't, you know, been to a grief counselor and hasn't read a book like yours, although I sent it to her this week, that if you are unconscious about what you feel, there is an intuition that will say to you like, okay, do something with this. Cause if anxiety is energy that we can kind of burn out of our bodies in, mm-hmm. in ways, which is not healing, but helpful, like, you know, or won't heal it, but will help it, I guess, mm-hmm. that you can build kind of a framework for all that you feel so that it can all find its own belonging.
Yeah. I love that. I think that's a really amazing way to look at it. And a lot of us really like don't lean into that intuition. Like we all innately know how to grieve. It's a birthright. You know, we know how to do this. We start grieving from childhood. We grieve pets. We grieve homes we lived in. We grieve teachers we move on from. You know, we grieve parents getting divorced or bigger losses, death, and so many things. But we begin grieving, you know, very early on in life, but we don't really recognize it as grief. And so we're not taking that time to honor the grief, which is what she's doing. She's making space for it. She's honoring it. She's having faith that there will be another side to it, that she will, like you said, that there will be joy again. And she's building the space for that, which is really incredible. I think a lot of people feel so blindsided by their grief. It's often a much bigger emotional experience than people are prepared for. They may have never felt this much, never felt so vulnerable, so scared, so, you know, consumed with emotions, and it can feel just really overwhelming. And so kind of everything will go out the window. People stop their routines. They stop, you know, doing the things that they need to do to take care of themselves. And actually just getting very simple and basic and structured is really helpful.
Well, do you feel it's also a way that, you know, grief is different for different personality types? So like mm-hmm. she's a doer, like she's got to mm-hmm. be like, if something's going wrong, she's the person you would call in a crisis as a friend. So it's like, if something's going wrong, you have your friends who are like, okay, let's make the list and then we'll get it done. And so it's also interesting because those people have a really amazing way of attacking grief in a way of like, yeah. okay, like, and that can lead to a way of rock bottoms. Like you were saying, part of your rock bottom was applying that anxiety into overachievement or channeling it into overachievement that can get to a numbing place as someone who's a recovering overachiever as well. But what about the person, do you think, who is like the deep feeler? What would be the offering to the person who's not like the, okay, got to get up and go, because I had the friend who is like that too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think there's some of us that, you know, lean towards the melancholy, really steep in the deep emotions, and we can just swim around in there for a long time. And for that, it is actually helpful to start adding some structure and to start adding some of the more doing action. And that can be very simple though. You know, it can be just small routines. It can be taking breaks from your grief. Like some of us do go that whole other way, where we just go so deep into the grief that we need to take breaks from it, and we need to laugh, and we need to build things, and we need to be creative, and we need to have fun. We need to work, we need to exercise. So adding in some of that to someone who is kind of steeping in it more is important. And then for someone else who's overachieving and overdoing, actually scheduling time, even I do this with clients who are in that space. Let's schedule time for you to steep in your grief. And that can look as simple as, you know, going through old photos, listening to music, like really evoking that emotion and letting yourself cry. Not everybody feels safe to do that. Some people have incredibly busy lives, demanding jobs, families, obligations, lack of resources. Like there's so many things that get in the way of us feeling safe enough to grieve, because it is so vulnerable. Like we go into a place where we feel very unlocked and unmoored and unanchored, you know? So it can be something that people really avoid.
Something you said in the book was grieving is a natural process. It's not something to rush or tidy up. Grief is not going to adhere to any timelines or formulas. Grief is a human response to losing someone or something that mattered deeply to you. When you think about it that way, wouldn't it be weird if you weren't grieving? That speaks so much to what you were saying about all the small griefs of, you know, the pets or the teachers or the this or the that. And again, I look at grief as this thing where it's like, if you just know what it is, that it's that big, chaotic, weird feeling thing with no real formula, no real timeline, there's something about that really sucks and is the worst news ever, and is also like the best news ever, because then you're free.
You don't have to try to make it into something. You don't have to try to like fix it or figure it out. You just let it be, you know? And there's a section in that book about kind of surrendering to that, you know, just surrendering to it and not trying to get your hands around it so tightly. It's impossible. You know, grief is going to have its way with you, and it's going to look different for everyone, but it's not always a bad thing. And especially in the first deep year of loss, there's some really beautiful opportunities of just fragility and self-exploration that come that are very different from later years of carrying loss.
Do you think that idea of surrender is helpful because we live in a culture of such kind of polarities of like, we passed something or we failed something, or we're doing a good job at grief, we're doing a bad job at grief, or we're watching someone else grieve online and we think it's wrong or it's right? Or like, do you think that we are constantly putting these like binaries and judgments on grief, but in surrender, everything's abstract, right? Because you're like, whatever is, and that looks 30 different ways.
Yeah, we put a lot of judgment on grief, both ourselves and as a culture. And I think people really receive these messages about what their grief is supposed to look like. And sometimes we receive those messages by knowing that bereavement leave is often less than a week. You know, that's a message right there. You get 5 days to grieve like your spouse. Are you serious? You know, like, but that's a message that says you should be able to only need 5 days to go through this immense loss, and then you've got to get back to work. Or we receive messages by people, you know, just forgetting that we're still grieving, not showing up for us, not acknowledging our loss, being afraid to talk about it with us. And so we begin to look at our own process as though we're doing something wrong, rather than that kind of intuitive place of, no, I need to be in this right now. I need to take time for myself. I need to heal. I need to find support. We listen to a lot of those messages because there's so much external noise, right? Instagram, everything. And we see other people doing things one way and just think automatically that we're doing it wrong. I hear from so many clients every day, like, I'm doing this wrong. I think I'm not crying enough, or I'm crying too much, or I'm angry, or I'm anxious. And I'm like, no, that's all grief, and it's okay.
Or as you were saying, when you were experiencing the grief of your parents, someone, you're kind of projecting the ways in which they would cope onto you. So saying, you have them for longer, just be grateful for this, or da-da-da-da. Like, I have felt it, that in my experience, and I've had two very close friends lose their parents really abruptly, and or three actually. And I have found that the only right answer as a friend, and correct me if I'm wrong, just as we just said, there's no right and wrong way to do it. But I have felt that what is the greatest offering as a friend is just to continuously say, this is fucked up. And
yeah, I think that's great.
Because it is. You're just like, this is fucked. Like, life happening in this way is life being life. And it's the hardest, weirdest, fucked up part of the whole thing.
Yeah.
And I sit in that, and whether it's my friend who's calling me 5 years later and is still like, I'm upset on this anniversary, or da-da-da, or the 2 year or the 3 year or whatever, or the 6 months or whatever it is, I'm like, yes, it's the worst thing ever.
Yeah. And if you say the opposite of that, which is like, oh, you're going to be okay, or it's okay, that's really invalidating what they're experiencing, and it shuts them down and it makes them doubt their grief. And so acknowledging that, I think, is perfect, you know, and it is fucked, and it's so hard, and it's so heartbreaking. And I think that we get really scared to let someone sit in that, you know, it's scary for us to see someone hurting. And so we want to fix it, and we want to tidy it up, and we want to tell them they're going to be okay.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it's not okay right now, and that's okay.
Well, and I think it kind of goes back to, you know, that thing you were saying of like, the more you know, the less you know, because it's also an invitation into the mystery, the question mark. And I find that there's a lot of comfort living in that and being like, I don't know, it's horrible. Like, because I think that takes you off of this kind of, or out of this like rat race of social norms of like, you know, you should have been at this place, and you, and your life would be this if this didn't, da-da-da, or blah, you know, all of these ways in which we are counting on social standards and circumstances to tell us whether or not we get to be happy or have joy at any particular moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of the times, if you can just kind of pull out from that and say, like, I don't know, I have no idea how things are supposed to be.
Right. And on that note, we can also say that grief doesn't have to be a horrible, bad thing. We don't have to look at it through this lens of like, oh, it's just it's ruined my life, or this is the worst thing, or I'm always going to feel like this. Grief, again, can really open us up to ourselves. It completely changes our ideas of the world. And in the beginning, that can be really scary. Again, if someone's listening and they're in the beginning of a loss, it's sometimes hard to hear that there's beauty coming, transformation, hope, but they really are available. But you have to go through this kind of fiery process of everything you thought you knew about the world and your life falling apart. And then you're standing in the embers and you're like, whoa, the whole landscape has just been leveled.
Yeah.
And from there, you begin to rebuild and reevaluate. And it's this incredible opportunity to figure out what's meaningful to you. You know, what do you want your life to be like? How do you want to show up to it? Who matters to you? When my parents were gone and I was 25, it was also, as painful as it was and scary, it was so liberating because nothing mattered. Like I could just clear out all the stuff that didn't matter. And I didn't get caught up as much in what I thought I should be doing. And I was really able to move towards things that meant something to me. You know, I'd been working jobs that weren't that meaningful and trying to make money and trying to be a writer and work for magazines. And I was like, I don't want to do this. This is not meaningful to me anymore. And it really set me off on a path to figuring out, you know, who I really wanted to be in the world and how I wanted to show up to it and myself.
When I was reading your book, I thought about this, that probably the question I'm asked the most is, how do you heal from heartbreak? And something I've always said is that, you know, when your heart is in pieces, it's an opportunity to intentionally put it back together in ways you never knew possible. And it's only when you have it all in pieces that you can do that.
Yeah, that's exactly the same with grief.
And that's exactly how I felt about reading your book, is that I was like, wow, someone is really naming kind of what you were saying, of being like, God, like, I don't know if I just, when my heart was the way it was built, was in shape the day I was born, without this heartbreak, would I have like known what my real dream was for myself? Would I have known this? Would I have like, was I kind of moving along, you know, you, whether it's you writing for your magazines or whatever you're doing, was I just going along with something because there was an kind of initial kind of dream in that original shape? Mm-hmm. And had I not been able to have that shape completely and utterly in pieces, and then found a way to almost spiritually, I'd say, make the decision to build it again,
yeah,
with deep intention, could I have the life that I, that is possible?
Absolutely. I think about that a lot, you know, who I am because of these losses. And, you know, I think there's a version where I would just take back my parents in a second and have a family again and have my kids know my parents and my mother get to be a grandmother. And then there's this other version where I'm like, but wait, what if I had to give up everything I've learned about myself and the world and who I've become and the compassion and the empathy and the, you know, the interest I have in just being human? You know, it's hard. I don't know.
The wait is over. That's right. Season 5 of The Kardashians is here. Just when you thought life couldn't get any faster, they're punching it into overdrive. Kris, Kourtney, Kim, Khloe, Kendall, and Kylie are back and continue to defy expectations in all their endeavors. So, get ready to go behind the glitz and glamour of the most iconic family on television. The all-new season of The Kardashians premieres May 23rd, streaming on Hulu.
The one mantra I say to myself every single day is, if you're grateful for where you are, you have to respect the road that got you there.
Mm.
And in respect, there's so much love in respect, mm-hmm. but it's not love the road you got that got you there. It's not like appreciate every single thing. It's not. It's actually like respect that like these things may, perhaps without a single one of these things happening, the best one or the worst one, does today get to unfold exactly the way it is. You know, does it yeah. create the desire to have a family, to rebuild your family? Do you know, does it create this desire to create these incredible offerings of grief counseling to us? And in that, there's so much respect to be found in our history, no matter how many tragedies we've had to endure.
Yeah, that's cool to look at it on such a big level. Yeah, I something similar, I think to myself, I have 3 kids and I'll think, you know, I don't want anything terrible to happen to them or anything hard to happen to them. I want to shield them from hardship. And then I think, why? You know, everything hard that's ever happened to me has made me a better person.
In knowing that truth, and I feel that every person would fundamentally feel that that is true, that they would say that, like, I've learned so much through what I've gone through. You know, whether they're able to kind of bravely say that it was the hard things that gave you the wisdom, but they would at least say that, like, where I have struggled, I have found lessons.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that grieving is just so taboo, or we are so deeply avoiding it as a culture and not kind of, I don't know, like putting more space around it, you know, like you're saying, without giving people leave, or, you know, culturally trying to brush over it or hope not to look at it? Is that fear?
I think the root is fear, absolutely. But I think we're also lacking ritual and structure. Mm. And I think we're lacking a framework for which to understand death and loss and, you know, history and future. And we're so distracted with so many immediate things that are in front of us that we aren't continuing to try to develop these things. The pandemic was a really interesting lens to view how we reacted in Western culture and America in particular to all this sudden loss and sudden change and people losing even the small rituals they had, people not being able to sit Shiva or go to funerals or, you know, have these memorials for people they were losing. And yet we still have that ability all the time. We can come up with the most creative things all on our own. We can find ways to honor people. We can find ways to connect with people we've lost. And when we're not doing that and not acknowledging it, I think there's a lot of fear there. And the fear just comes up all the time because we're not exploring what does death and dying mean. We're not facing end of life to begin with. We don't even teach death and dying and end of life in medical school. Our doctors and nurses are not learning about end of life and death and grief. And same is true for psychology. There was nothing required in my grad school program for death, dying, and grief.
That's crazy.
It was an elective. I know. Yet every therapist I know deals with grief on some level, whether or not they specialize in it. People bring grief into the office nonstop. Yet nobody's trained in it. It's mind-blowing. And so there's a lot of fear around it because nobody knows enough and nobody talks about it.
Is that why? So in your book, you say that there's the four orientations and it's entering, engaging, surrendering, and transforming. Is that why you say that you kind of wanted to emphasize entering as the first?
Yeah. I mean, I think we enter into grief, you know, often without a choice. Again, like loss happens to us and we kind of enter into this space of grieving and it's really disorienting. And the beginning of that kind of grief, we're just trying to, you know, find our balance, figure out where we are, look at this new landscape, and we've entered into it without a lot of knowledge, you know, because often we haven't had role models for what it looks like to grieve. We weren't talked to about it as children. You know, we're really failing in this way in terms of talking to kids about death and dying and grief. No one's prepared for it. So we enter into grief without a map, and yet there we are. And so the second part of engaging with it is starting to really be like, okay, here I am. What do I do with this? Yet it's also at the same time really healing. Whereas women, again, will tend to be more open to talking about their grief with friends, with family, with even strangers in a Zoom support group, you know?
Yeah. I think a lot about in ways I've like watched things when I was younger. And I was like, yes, I learned how to be a friend who is there for another friend by watching Steel Magnolias, because I watched this group of women and I was like, oh, you still get to laugh. And if somebody cries, or, and there's no wrong way, and you still should be yourself.
Yeah.
And it all happens in a group. Whereas you don't know where like Selby's husband was, like where his grief was like taking place.
There is no male equivalent of Steel Magnolias.
Yeah. I think about when we watched the kind of Michael Jordan 10 episode thing when it came out, and there's the game where he just cries and cries and cries, but it's like, he actually had lost his dad that year, but there's no interviews, conversations, there's no books, there's no documentary on like him losing his dad or him mysteriously losing this other guy that was worked in the locker room, that was an elder that took care of him. But there's this one game where he just let himself fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
And what's really interesting is that you, as the woman watching that, I was like, oh, he must have been grieving his dad. And,
Absolutely. But
we didn't have a conversation about grief in my household as we were watching it. We're like, yeah, he was really emotional because whatever happened to his dad, but it would just went right back to just that there was death, but not that there was then grief.
But that's one of those messages again, right?
Yeah.
That men don't talk about grief. And so they receive those messages. And so then they follow them and don't talk about it. But then they're stuffing it down and they're feeling isolated and they're feeling like they're doing something wrong. And it's heartbreaking. I am so grateful to Anderson Cooper and Stephen Colbert for talking about grief so much in recent years. And because they're really taking that lead as being men who are being so open about their experience of loss and grief.
Do you think there are symptoms of grief that we don't associate with grieving? Like, we know the things that like we just talked about, but when you were saying that you reached rock bottom, like, do you think there's ways that we reach rock bottom that we just wouldn't assign as rock bottom? Do you think there's ways that we see symptoms of grief that we just are like, oh my God, that's my grief, and I didn't know?
Yeah. I mean, I think we're all carrying so much collective grief right now, and it's making it difficult to go back to work or to do different things. And we're not attributing it to grief. You know, we're attributing it to all sorts of other things. And I think the main problem actually lies in not the symptoms, but just acknowledging all the different things we grieve and how often we are grieving. And I think anxiety is a very overlooked symptom of grief that I've been talking about for a while. Mm-hmm. And it's a place we go to, one, because we're avoiding, you know, other emotions of grief. So it spills out in anxiety, or the grief itself, the loss itself has really changed our lives so much that it's created a lot of anxiety about the future, about our identities. And so it's creating this feeling of, you know, not feeling safe, not knowing who we are. When we're grieving, we can't always depend on who we used to be. You know, when we go out in the world, we go to a social gathering after a big loss, or we go to work, or we're parenting, and we're not the same. And we can't always rely on ourselves to be steady or to not you know, have a breakdown or to not be consumed and distracted by the loss itself. And so there's so much that's changing just in terms of knowing who we are, and that causes a lot of anxiety.
Do you think that in that there's also like this way that we allow ourselves to like live with sadness? Because sometimes I think we don't allow ourselves to have certain emotions unless they're bringing us to our knees. So we allow ourselves to have it, but we're not acknowledging it. So it's like, do you think also one of the symptoms of grief or just like that I am just a little sad? But we sometimes think that if it's not this sadness that is like debilitating, that we can't say I'm sad or allow ourselves to say I'm just a little sad all the time. Therefore, it is a thin veil between who I am and what I'm processing.
Mm-hmm. You're right about sadness. Often we think it needs to be this really huge thing that either completely, you know, knocks us down or that we have to rehabilitate from, rather than just being able to carry these kind of small feelings of sadness that come up throughout the day, maybe feelings of nostalgia or missing or memory, you know, these kind of sense memories that will come when we carry loss, and letting that be okay. And even listening to them, having that intuitive moment of like, why is this like moment of sadness coming when I was seemingly fine earlier?
And perhaps maybe listening to what it's asking us to do. Cause mm-hmm. I have found definitely that I've just been experiencing, I think I've had so many of my close friends have these really traumatic losses over the past couple of years. And it just makes me a little sad throughout the day. And then in that sadness, sometimes I'll say like, you know, I want to end the day early because I just want to be with my kids, because that is a way in which I'm feeling grateful for aliveness mm-hmm. and life. Because I do think, and as your books talk about ways in which grief asks you to reprioritize. And so even if the grief is not, it's not yours completely, because I couldn't say that someone else's father's grief is my grief, but mm-hmm. I grieve with them and have an experience around it also that, wouldn't you say, would be kind of weird for me to not want to, or anyone to not want to have their own micro changes of like, oh yeah, I saw what I felt from this loss and going through this with my friend really made me want to parent this way or spend my time this way. Or when I'm seeing this mass kind of war and mass, you know, death and grief, collective grieving of us globally, I find that it's creating these kind of threads of sadness, and each thread of sadness is really kind of propelling a small shift throughout how I'm living in my, you know, in each 24-hour cycle of mm-hmm. my life.
Yeah, I love that. I always say grief asks a lot of us. And I feel like all of those things you're describing are really, they can be looked at as opportunities. Sometimes we'll brush them aside, you know, like a public figure will die and we'll feel that sadness. And then we'll say to ourselves, oh no, I didn't even know that person. I shouldn't feel this. Rather than, you know, looking at it as an opportunity to feel something and examine something about how we want to be in the world. Or like, you know, a friend loses somebody and we're having an experience around that. Absolutely. And so often we will dismiss that as, no, I can't have this experience. This is her grief. This is her loss. Yeah. Yet I think every single one is an opportunity to get to know ourselves better and examine that, those meaningful moments of our lives.
Well, because it's also a fine line with friends, because, you know, you don't want to center your experience, but it's also weird to not have an experience. Mm-hmm. And you just, I think the line, the boundary to me is always that my experience is never my friend's problem.
Right.
So totally. I never, you know, yeah, it's like, absolutely. It's my business. Like, I've got to like,
I'm you're not going to go to her and be like, I'm so sad today. I need you to help take care of me, you know, about your dad.
Exactly. Like, it's not your problem, but it is still my experience. And I think that is, you know, how I kind of go through being in community with others who experience loss, is to like, say, you know, is to not live without being affected, but to know that like, if it's not central to me and it is mine, right? Mm-hmm. Like, because don't you think there's some type of ownership of like, you know, there's almost the, like you're not taking ownership of the person that's being grieved, but you are just, you know, allowing yourself to feel that grief is present, and grief, as you say, changes us mm-hmm. and all of us, your whole tribe too.
Yeah. I saw, especially during the pandemic, a lot of what I call grief shaming, where people would, you know, somebody would be expressing something online about something they've lost, you know, maybe not being able to go to their kids' graduation or something. And then other people would jump on them and say, you know, oh, you should, you know, there's so many people who have it so much worse. And that just broke my heart. It invalidates everyone's experience and robs them of that opportunity to kind of investigate that sadness and, you know, what it offers us.
And I guess also that fear of being shamed. You know, I have a friend who always says, just because your hard time isn't a 10, don't let that like 10 bribe you out of feeling you're 6, you know, because like, so it's like, just feel what you feel like, and know maybe the appropriate kind of like space, not appropriate as in it's wrong or right, but where it should be held. Because what it might be is, and I think we're learning this with how we engage online, is that perhaps with a group of strangers and with no regulation is perhaps actually where that doesn't belong, so that you can safely feel without judgment whatever you feel, because whatever you're feeling is always correct. Like, you know, because it's leading you, whether it's irrational, rational, whatever, it's still the starting place for something you're needing to heal, figure out, shake out, know, and move, so that you can kind of keep going.
And this is where, you know, this is why so many people struggle in their grief, because they enter into it and suddenly they're bombarded with all these different messages and forms of what they should feel and how long they should feel it and what it should look like. And, you know, it's hard to find your way back to that intuition. And so again, this is the whole point of conscious grieving, is how do we really take a step back from all of the external stuff and get in tune and get to know our own grief.
So after you've gotten to know it and you've kind of entered into, engaged with, found a way to surrender, and you get to transforming, or you get to transformation, what has that looked like for yourself, your clients, and then how have you seen it manifest?
I think back to the way you described the opportunity that comes with heartbreak. You know, it's like everything's in pieces around you, but now is this opportunity to rebuild it and transform what your old heart used to be like and this old experience into something really new, into a new version of yourself, in which you move into your life and forward into your life with more intention, a clearer understanding of who you are, what your relationships are like, mortality, time, so many things, how you want to, you know, approach the end of your own life. You can't go through a significant loss without thinking about death and dying and what happens next. Yeah. And those are big, scary things, yet they also lend themselves to this transformation of getting clearer about who we are. And there's a lot of beauty in that. And I think I've seen so many clients come through the really hard space and begin to rebuild, discard pieces of their lives or themselves that weren't serving them, move into different spaces that they find just so enriching, you know, with their relationships change. They kind of figure out really what they want to do and how they want to show up in their world. And there's a lot of like power and just, it can be just so profound to see that.
Something I've thought about, or I reflect on a lot, in the energy of transformation, and I felt this a lot in your kind of chapter on it, is the word rebirth. And this idea that when something happens that truly kind of brings us to our knees or shakes us to our core or puts us into pieces, there's also this energy of a rebirth, because I think a lot of the times we think that transformation is a transition from one place to another. Mm-hmm. But in transition, I have found that there's like a wrestling with a past and a present. Whereas in a rebirth, like, no, everything is new and everybody feels differently and every energy feels differently. And even where you live might feel like a completely different place, or where your, you know, kids go to school, may, like, which felt like a great place, is now not a great place for you, or all these things, and allowing this rebirth to happen where you're like, wow, I'm like a newborn child. And that's why I need these kind of fragile energies. And then as I kind of am growing, regrowing up, I'm re-meeting people of comfort in my new life, and forgiving yourself for not wanting to try to straddle an old life before this rebirth.
Yeah, I think also one of the things that's really interesting about rebirth in terms of grief is that there's also a rebirth of your relationship with the person you lost. So when you lose someone significant, it feels like that relationship has been severed. There's a physicality that's gone. They're no longer walking into a room. You can't pick up the phone and call them anymore. And it feels like that relationship is over. And one of the things that you really discover in that transformation process of grief is that there is an ability to kind of reconnect, instill this new relationship with them. My mom's been gone for 27 years, and I still feel like I am in relationship with her all the time. You know, I think about her in different ways all the time. I get to know her as I become ages she was, as I become a mother. I'm having my kids get to know her. There's a whole rebirth of that relationship that felt elusive to me in the beginning of grief. I just, in the beginning, you can't conceptualize how you're going to get to that place after this very physical relationship. And yet when you move through those other parts of grief, you eventually do land in this place where you realize that you still have a relationship with them. And then there's opportunity to cultivate that even more.
Well, with that amazing advice of something that's in kind of the more like evolved space of grief being if you can get to the transformation spot, I'd love to kind of end with what would be the kind of main offering to someone who's in, you know, year one, day one, where the idea that they're even entering into a phase of anything because the pain and the loss also feels like such an abstract attack on oneself.
Yeah.
What would be your kind of main offering to them?
To begin just by acknowledging the grief, stepping into it, engaging with it, understanding that this is happening. And rather than trying to fix it, trying to avoid it, trying to move through it, get over it, you know, just kind of be done with it and go back to who you were, you know, it's more about who you're going to be through this process and owning that you are in this place. I think it's really helpful to get support in grief. For a really big loss, I think it's helpful to, it can be listening to a podcast, it can be reading a book, it can be going to therapy, a support group, but just really kind of giving yourself that permission to be in your grief. And often we don't get that permission even from family members. So we may have to seek elsewhere for it, but we have to start by just being in it. And it's actually the hardest thing because everyone tries to move out of it as quickly as possible. So my biggest advice would be to just be in it, but you might need support to be in it.
Yeah. And sometimes the support is trying to move you out of it too, because it's uncomfortable for everyone, you know? Yeah. And so, and that discomfort and so hard because no one wants to see people they love in pain.
I know.
Is there advice you have for the person who's trying to support someone who's in grief right now?
Just the reminder that you don't have to do anything. There is no right thing to say. You just show up, just be there, just acknowledge their loss and just tell them that you're there and, you know, do things that they're not asking for. I always hear people get annoyed when they're like, everyone's asking me what they can do. I don't even know. So don't ask, just do stuff, you know, go over, take out their trash, drop off some food, text them, you know, let them know you're thinking of them and show up long past you think they need it. You know, often we give people like three months, we show up for them for three months. And then we're like, oh, I think they're good now, or they should be good. Some people aren't even like getting to their grief until 6 months, 12 months.
Especially because so many people deal with the logistics. Because I feel like there's the point in which, especially if the grief is so near to you and your family, for the first 3 months, people are dealing with the logistics, the will, the bank accounts, the this, the that.
Yeah.
And so I do find that the grief really starts to happen when they no longer have to, they're no longer in over their head with the logistics of the death.
That's exactly right. And their brain has finally kind of like caught up to what's happened, the actuality of it. And so then they're really feeling it. And that's at the exact same time when everybody drops away. Wow. So keep showing up.
Claire, thank you so much. This has been one of my very favorite conversations for the pod. I'm so grateful.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for this amazing book. And also your book on anxiety is so incredible, even though I know this is your new one, but I recommend both to anyone here, and I'm personally going to get them for my friends. So thank you so much again. Thank you for your time and for really giving and providing this service for so many. It is not work that most people want to do. And so it's a real labor of love, I can tell and feel. So thank you.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. Thank you for making space for this conversation.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode with Claire Bidwell Smith. Her book, Conscious Grieving, is out now today on March 12th. It's a beautiful guide to grief and feels like having a friend walk beside you on your healing journey. I hope you'll pick up a copy.
Thanks for tuning in. This has been a presentation of Cadence 13 Studios. I hope you'll listen, follow, rate, and review all of our episodes, which are available for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Odyssey, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening to the Goop Podcast.